the reliability, the credibility of my work, it kind of hinges on the public's trust in the work that I do. And if we have things in place that can erode that trust, further erode that trust, which it, you know, happens, it seems, regularly at this point, then that it's not entirely helpful.
Well, welcome back to the Public Money Pod, a production of the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. And we are proudly sponsored by Build America Mutual, the Government Finance Officers Association, MuniPro, and Odyssey Advisors. I'm Justin Marlowe, and I'm joined, as always, by my intrepid co-host, purveyor of long story short, Californian Marylander, Liz Farmer. Liz, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin. And I don't know what the weather's been like in Chicago lately, but we've been getting hints of spring here in Maryland, which I'm sure will all come crashing down on us as it tends to do in the mid-Atlantic. We have, you know, the fake spring and then second winter. So right now we're in fake spring, second winter is coming, and then eventually the actual spring will be here. But it's been nice to enjoy a bit of sunshine anyway.
Yes, definitely a little teaser there. You know, the same. It went from like 70 degrees to 30 degrees in about 24 hours, which is just to keep things interesting, keep people in the game, I suppose. Yes, definitely a ways off yet for spring, but we'll get there soon enough. Well, we're talking today about AI. We've talked about AI on this podcast all the time. In fact, we probably could have an entire podcast just about AI and state and local government, because it is such an ubiquitous topic. But today we want to take a very kind of particular view of it. And we want to talk specifically about AI in state government and the way that the auditing function in state government thinks about AI. We're fortunate to have Casey Kopcho, who is an auditor with the Oregon Secretary of State, and in that role touches on lots of different kinds of audit questions in state government, many of which either directly or indirectly intersect with budgeting and finance. You know, one of the things that inspired this particular conversation was the fact that there are lots of different states considering different types of either regulatory action or, at a minimum, studies, attempts to just understand the implications of AI in state government writ large. It touches everything. It can touch everything. It's obviously evolving very, very quickly. So you see lots of states just trying to get their arms around where it is, where it's going, and what it means for how we staff state government, what it means for how we deliver certain state government services. And then, of course, in the public money world, the big question is, what are the costs and what are the potential cost savings associated with this? Sometimes those effects can be tossed out relatively straightforward ways. Sometimes they can't. And of course, again, because this touches essentially everything that we do in state government, it has financial implications. It certainly is going to affect the budget, but it's really early and it's tough to know exactly what those impacts might be. Liz, you've looked at this, you know, as much as anyone, and have looked in some cases really carefully at some of the cost and benefit and workforce questions. When you think about this relationship between AI and how state government services are going to be delivered, what comes to mind for you?
Yeah, I think it's really appropriate that we're talking to an auditor who focuses on, you know, auditors about risk, and AI certainly poses a lot of risks, and in good ways and bad ways. And what really kind of gets me about this is that it's sort of it's a trope that state governments are constantly behind in adopting technology, and this technology is like the fastest moving technology I can remember seeing, at least in my lifetime. And it's befuddling, I think, in terms of how our state government's going to ride this. And the approach so far, at least from a legislative perspective, has been very much about regulation, privacy, and safety, kind of those big umbrella items. I think according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, at least 25 states and Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia introduced artificial intelligence bills last year. 18 of them and Puerto Rico adopted resolutions or enacted legislation. A lot of these are kind of like dipping a toe in the water type things. Task forces, governors have also established task forces as well. So, I mean, states are getting into it, but I think when you think about how fast moving this technology is, it's going to be interesting to watch in terms of how they're able to keep up with something that is constantly evolving. Generative AI, I mean, it's right there in the title too with that one. And just as an example, I was looking at a bill that Maryland is considering this year in 2024, and it is it's essentially a bill that would require the Secretary of Information Technologies, that department, to annually evaluate the feasibility of different state government departments providing public services using AI and other related technologies. That has a cost impact. It's not very big for this one, but when you think about just adding evaluation to the list of things that a state government employee is going to have to do, this one comes with a price tag of between $150,000 to less than about $200,000 every year for the next 4 years. And that's just one tiny, tiny sliver. Basically, it's like, if you want to think about AI, here's what it's going to cost. not to mention, what is it going to cost when you actually adopt things? And, you know, there's also the cost savings potential for AI too. And figuring out how to balance all that is something that really is not something I think that's risen to the surface yet, because as I mentioned, there's so much stuff about concerns about safety and privacy. We have an election coming up. There's a lot of concern about AI in that as well. So I think we are just skimming the surface here, and it's going to be interesting to see how quickly it takes states to really connect this back to the budget.
Agreed. And if the old adage holds from capital budgeting, I'm not sure if it's a good connection or not, but of course the old rule in capital budgeting is for every dollar you spend on planning, you'll spend $10 in construction and eventually $100 on maintenance and operations. So if that's the case, take that $100,000 estimate and add a few zeros, and pretty soon we're talking about real money in state budgets, which probably should be no surprise. I think the fact that there's dollars set aside to study it every year is different. That's not something that we often do in state government, just this recognition that we don't know what we don't know, and it's important to understand and just observe this as it evolves rather than making any sort of bold policy moves at this early stage in the game. But it's going to move fast. It is moving fast, and it's only going to move faster. Certainly will make for some very interesting questions around how states plan for and ultimately spend money. Well, we are pleased to welcome to the Public Money Pod, Casey Kopcho, who is Principal Auditor with the Oregon Secretary of State. Casey, thanks so much for giving us some time here on the Public Money Pod.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're very excited to have you. We are going to be talking about AI, which it seems like everybody wants to talk about all the time now. I can't tell you how many emails I've gotten, press releases that are just AI related. And you and I met fairly recently when I was working on an AI related piece. And I would like to start off by asking you just about your personal experience with AI. Its usage has exploded, it seems to me, over the last 6 months. What's your kind of story with learning how to use AI and how you've started using it in your personal life?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. It's good that we're getting very personal in the first question. Personal. You know, I think it's important to understand what we mean by AI. So if we want to be technical, what my personal use of AI goes back to the 90s with some video games. I can remember when Garry Kasparov lost to the IBM Deep Blue in the 90s. And that was a huge moment for me, who was a nerdy kid. But then my first personal use came in after Christmas of 1998, when my little sister got what every kid wanted that year, which was a Furby. And what folks might not recognize is that Furbies were chatbots. They actually learned through human language and grew more intelligent over time. That's not to say they were very intelligent ever to begin with, but it was an iteration of a chatbot, albeit a very early and rudimentary one. So when I think of my kind of first foray into the world of AI, I remember the Furby that I did not like very much, that would never stop talking, and think of it that way. But in terms of a more modern take of AI and machine learning and deep learning, which I think gets so confusing that it's hard to even talk about in a public setting or in a group of friends. You just say AI just kind of ubiquitously to mean all the things. And we could talk about the story behind that. But my use of it, I actually also in 98, dating myself horribly. And it's weird to even say that I'm dating myself with the 90s. I feel bad about that.
I understand that.
But in 1998, a group of friends of mine started a video game that is a text-based online video game, which we still run to this day. And I started using generative AI to help build out that entirely text-based world, last March, about a year ago, because having the ability to just put in a prompt and generate walls and walls of text to create this world online saved me a heck of a lot of time than typing out all of this stuff that very few people read, considering very few people still play this archaic game from the 90s to begin with. So that's really where I started experimenting with it. And from there, just kind of kept learning how to apply the different technology in kind of my day-to-day as I do stuff outside of work. Because there's a lot of applications outside of just ChatGPT. Although even with that, I tell my kids, I'm like, hey, what's something that's interesting to you? And we'll put a few prompts into ChatGPT and have it kind of create this story for them about characters they like from a video game or from books, and we'll have them kind of do this task or whatever it is. And it's often very funny. It's kind of like a modern day Mad Libs, and that's really fun. Or with image generation, kids will have a lot of fun just putting in kind of wacky stuff or whatever characters that they want to come up with. One of my children loves cats, so a lot of cats end up getting generated. And in that sense, it's a lot of fun too. So I think personal use, there are both a lot of kind of practical applications as well as a lot of fun applications.
I wonder if we could maybe drill into a specific type of AI application, certainly the one that we seem to talk about most often, at least on this podcast, when we talk about AI, and that's the notion of generative AI, especially these large language models and such. If you could talk a little bit more about that particular part of AI and some of the unique concerns that you and other auditors have raised about that specific application.
Sure. Yeah. It's the one that I like to talk about the most too, because it's the one that gets talked about the most. So when I talk about it, people tend to listen. So I'm happy to discuss it. I won't necessarily talk about the concerns of other auditors because I don't want to put words in their mouths. However, this is me speaking like an auditor who will qualify virtually everything I say. What I'll say, my concerns stem with a number of things, and that starts with the input risks and output risks of generative AI. And so when we're talking about input risks, we're talking about those risks that are the result of the inputs into the technology in the first place. And then output risks are the risks of using whatever comes out from that generative AI, whether it's ChatGPT or an DALL-E or an image or video. So from an input perspective, the first one that I talk about or think about is selection bias. And so to train these models, we are scraping the internet, we're gathering just enormous amounts of data. But what data? And who selects it? And that data inherently is already going to have bias, no matter how you selected it, because it's just an enormous amount of data. And if we're scraping it from the internet, guess what, folks? The internet has a lot of bias. So we have to understand that risk as we kind of move forward with it. The second risk I think of is data transparency risk. If we're gathering all of this information and the companies, the private organizations who are creating these models and APIs, we don't necessarily as governments have a window into that corpus of information, that body of information that was used to train that AI. And if I don't, as an auditor or as a state entity, have a window into what that looks like, then it's hard for me to be able to rely on it if I can't see what it is I'm supposed to be relying on. So there's some inherent risk in that. And we either have to accept that if we're going to use it or reject that and decide not to use it or come up with an alternative. The third one that I think about is, and this is still an input risk, is security and privacy. So again, anything that we put into one of these chatbots is now in the hands of a third party. So if I am a government entity and one of my staff people who has not been trained on what not to put in this is putting in sensitive information or personally identifiable information or just information generally that they should not be putting into this, well, that's no longer in my control as the state. Now that's in the hands of someone else. And depending on the terms of and conditions of that agreement with that company, it may just be theirs. And now also, if their system gets compromised and I don't have a window into what their security protocols look like, then that information could get into hands of other folks. So we just add more layers to this issue of security and privacy that we need to deal with. And then the fourth thing that I think of in terms of input is a consumption risk. The energy required to run these models, to train them, is rather large in terms of electricity that we're using and emissions that we're generating as a result. So as we move into a world where we're trying to cut back on emissions and cut back on energy consumption, how does this fit into that window. And so those are just the input risk. The first thing I think of in an output scenario is social bias. So in an input scenario, we have what I called selection bias, and that's the information that was selected that is biased. When we get an output and it is a biased output, for example, when I give lectures, I'll show a prompt for an image generator where I've asked it to show me a picture of a doctor, and it shows me a picture of a white guy in a lab coat. And I'll say it again and again and again and again, and every picture will be the same picture. There's a bias there, and that's the social bias. A doctor is a white guy in a lab coat. Obviously, that's what I'm trying to show you. But that's not always the case. As we well know, there are doctors of many genders, of many different colors in the world, and that's the way it is. But we have to understand that if we're going to use it, and we have to train people to understand that there's a social bias that comes into play. And it's not just images that can result. You can ask for ChatGPT to tell you a story about a married couple that has marital problems. And every time it'll be a cisgendered married couple, usually like Tom and Sally, very anglicized names, every single time. And we have that bias that's inherent in the system. So we have to then be trained to have our users be able to prompt the thing to maybe give it better examples rather than having it be more customized or tailored to the world at large. So the next output issue that I think of, and probably the one that gets the most media attention, is just intentional misuse. You know, famously, there was the Pope Balenciaga saga that happened last year in 2023, where there was this viral picture of the Pope wearing a very fancy puffer coat. And everybody thought, oh my gosh, this is real. And I thought, hey, look at him. He's styling. That's, you know, good for him. But, you know, that's more innocuous. But we have, you know, at the same time, running rampant over Twitter or X or whatever it's called today, pictures of Taylor Swift, right, that are generative AI created. That's a malicious kind of thing that happens. And so we have this serious risk from misuse. And that's not even getting into the scalability of attacks with phishing or with misinformation, or as we get into campaign season for the elections, that it can be used there. So there's a lot of risk when it comes to the ability to just press a button, hit a prompt, and be malicious. So there's work to be done to mitigate that risk. The next risk is just hallucinations. I think this tends to be more innocuous, but in my world in auditing, if we're going to rely on this in a government setting, we need to be careful in understanding that what comes out of the system isn't always reliable. We need to verify the information. The adage in auditing is trust but verify. But I think I say just verify. There's not trust, and you're not going to offend the generative AI by not trusting it. Just verify the information that you got from it. The fourth thing I think about in terms of risk, and the last one in both input and output, is just quality. So right now, you know, it's still early days, even though it advances rapidly, is the quality of the output from generative AI may not be, and is often not, up to the standard of professional excellence in an organization. So to just get it and rely on that as your end product, I would say does yourself and the organization a disservice. So those are all of the risks that I think of immediately when it comes to using the technology.
I'm particularly interested in the issues of trust, and you didn't quite use the word cybersecurity, but I am, and I know that's one of the things that you were talking about there. Can you tell us a little bit about how some of the implications for cybersecurity for these deep fakes, what concerns as an auditor, particularly a Secretary of State auditor with a big election coming up in 2024, what are some of the concerns there for you?
There are many. So I think the biggest ones are just the ability for information to proliferate online, which can interfere with the democratic process, mm-hmm. And misrepresent candidates who are running campaigns. And so that's a concern in a scenario where there are no tools to combat that. I don't know the degree to which that will happen at a local level, you know, because the technology, I don't know if it's quite there for, you know, school board candidates to deploy the technology so rapidly, as opposed to maybe, you know, a much larger organization. But it's still a risk that's present that needs to be talked about and addressed swiftly. Our office, the Secretary of State, put out a report a year and a half ago, 2022, on the subject of domestic violent extremism. And in that, we found a growing concern among experts in that field on online proliferation of these ideologies, of misinformation in particular, to just kind of sow the seeds of discord. And so if we have a technology that's capable of veiling itself under the guise of legitimacy and rapidly, then that only increases the level of threat from the misinformation campaigns that exist. And so being able to combat that is going to be important. What that looks like, I have yet to see. But I will say, I did read a report on people not trusting AI, I think was the takeaway. There was a low trust in AI. And after reading the report, I got the sense that people just don't trust the people that use the AI. And that's more the concern. So I think it's more of a public trust issue with government in general. And that's a concern for me, again, as an auditor for the Secretary of State, who I am not representing in this conversation. I could maybe make a statement on that. But all of these representations are my own thoughts. But as someone who does this work, the reliability, the credibility of my work, it kind of hinges on the public's trust in the work that I do. And if we have things in place that can erode that trust, further erode that trust, which happens, it seems regularly at this point, then that it's not entirely helpful. And I can put it that way.
So we've covered all the bad sides, so to speak, of generative AI. We can pivot to why it's a good idea. What are some of the potential advantages that you are seeing in your work? And how can we put these tools to use to do good things?
Sure. Yeah. I don't know if we've covered all of the bad sides. I have a whole long slew of work that I've written on the ethics of AI. That said, I think there are a number of advantages to being able to deploy the technology. From a workforce perspective, my office just put a report out. I co-authored the report last week. It came out on the workforce crisis in Oregon specifically. And one of the biggest things I think this technology can do is allow us as state entities to do more with less, which is something that we're constantly being asked to do. And early on last year, when talking about Gen AI to folks in audit offices, who sometimes in a local, government is just one person, and they'll say, well, how do I use this? Like, this doesn't apply to me. This applies to folks that have 70 or 100 or more people. And I say, no, this probably applies to you more than anyone else, because using generative AI can allow you to do a lot of the things that, quote, don't matter, but you have to get done. Administrative tasks, calendars, note-taking, summary write-ups, and all of these different things that can be done very quickly and efficiently with AI and reliably. So this isn't asking, the AI to come up with something that you're going to turn. This is asking, hey, I have this body of this volume of text, consolidate it down to one page. It can do that. You can then proof it and then hand it off after you've put your stamp of approval on it. That's a lot faster than trying to synthesize 100 pages of information and turning that, over into an executive summary. So I think that's one of the biggest areas that I see a way that we can use this to our advantage. I don't think it solves the workforce crisis by any means, but I do think it's a factor to consider in understanding how it can positively affect the situation that doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. So we do mention generative AI in the report that we released, just in terms of a technology disruptor. And so will it displace? Will folks lose their jobs is a question that I get asked all the time. It's not one that I can answer again, and people don't like that I can't give answers. Be that as it may, I think another advantage is we can use it to do things that we just simply couldn't before. So in terms of agriculture or transportation, there are AI deployments that can allow us to be very precise in how we build out our agriculture infrastructure and be more efficient and effective with limited resources and allow farmers to do their jobs better. Those technologies aren't necessarily free or easy to use, and there's a learning curve, so we have to be very cognizant of how we deploy them, how we train and educate folks on making sure that they're used, or maybe how if there are conversations around subsidization programs for making that happen. To the same degree, I was a planning commissioner for a long time, so public transit is something that's near and dear to my heart. So there are transportation use cases for generative AI and understanding how these complex transportation models can work and then deploying those technologies in that way. So I think there's a workforce element that's certainly a huge one, but there are other than applications from a government perspective where we can deploy generative AI technologies to make systems run more efficiently and more effectively with the technology. So whenever I think of how we do stuff as a government, there's three things. There's people, process, and technology. And so we're going to have, you know, more investment potentially into this technology pillar, but then that's going to vary, right, from state to state. Some states might lean into it more. Some states might be more risk averse to it and say, you know what, this doesn't sit with us, and our risk appetite is not, you know, we're not down with that. And so I think from that perspective, it's going to be really fascinating to see how the workforce responds. So are folks, especially in a hybrid or remote environment, where if there are states that are leaning more into that technology, logically, that state might invest more in remote capability. So the folks could be able to take a job with another state, but still stay in the home state, which is not investing in that same technology. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
I heard someone talking about this in the context of writing, but it certainly applies everywhere. I mean, like you just said, it seems like, assuming you're aware of all those input and output risks you described, AI has the potential to allow people to do what they do best, which is that critical thinking, that decision making, that kind of executive functioning stuff that really only we human beings should be in charge of doing. And talking about using it to help government folks do their jobs better, I'm reminded of reading about how some state DOTs are using AI to be able to predict, you know, when the right time would be to perform maintenance on a bridge or road or that kind of thing, so that it doesn't fall apart and then you end up spending more money and lots of other terrible things, which ultimately is a cost savings. This is the public money pod. So let's bring it to the state budgets and financial risk. What kinds of impacts do these pros and cons potentially have on state spending?
It depends, right? It depends on the state. As I said before, you're going to have some states that react differently than other states, and I won't name names, but I won't be able to speak, you know, to necessarily how Oregon will respond. Oregon did stand up late last year. The governor did issue an executive order that stood up an AI council to see how we can move forward, you know, in an ethical, transparent kind of fashion. How it impacts the budget, it's difficult to say, but my guess is that, you know, when you think of it again in those three pillars, people, place, and technology, let's say in a system where we don't have any, and government systems are not systems in which we're not generating money generally. We have tax revenue, but we don't have a lot of income. We're not profit driven. So we have a finite amount of resources that we can dedicate to people, process, and technology. And if we've decided that, hey, we want to lean a little more into this technology piece to deploy that, then we can shift the investments either from people or process over to technology and deploy it there. Now, what does that do ultimately for the bottom line as far as cost savings are concerned? It's yet to be seen, right? But my guess is it'll be a real long-term process to really understand the implication, because you're going to have to train folks. And if you're training folks, that's not cheap. So even if it's cheaper to deploy the technology than it would be to have people doing certain tasks, you have to train the people to be able to do it. And that upfront cost, you could then amortize over time, right? Or capitalize, however you want to do it. But I think it's a very tricky question to answer. And as an auditor, those are my nemesis. I'll say that because I want to hedge all of my bets. So I think that there are cost savings that are realizable. As you kind of pointed out in the lead-in, from transportation to agriculture to many other facets of important government work, the technology can be leveraged to do it more efficiently. What we do with the savings is the question, because the government still has the funding. So if we save $100 million through the deployment of the technology, do we shift that $100 million to funding, you know, safer roads, for children to get to school? Where does that go? And so that kind of begets the question that I think of. So if this, then okay, well, now what's the next question in the chain? Because now we have this other problem to deal with. But I think someone once said to me when I said, that's a slippery slope. And they said to me, well, if it's a slippery slope, then you're acknowledging the problem. And if you're acknowledging the problem, then we can think of what to do if and when that happens. So I don't like to think in terms of the slippery slope anymore. So I guess that's the trouble I have in determining, the budget impact, I think is tricky because it's so highly variable. But I think ultimately there will be cost savings. But what happens as a result is going to be very dependent on the jurisdiction. I think that we need to be cognizant when we set up these councils and committees, and we haven't gotten to this, but I did allude to the council in Oregon that got set up at the national level. The White House put out an executive order on AI, which helped stand up the National Institute of Standards and Technologies AI Safety Institute Consortium. But when we do this, we have to be careful not to create camels, which is an expression that I like to use a lot because it makes people say, why is he talking about camels? But for folks in my field, the term or the expression is a camel is just a horse designed by committee, which is fun to think about. But we have to be careful of falling into that, right? So if we create all of these committees, then are we going to spend so much time trying to come up with the perfect approach to this? And while we're spending this time, this technology is advancing so much more rapidly than the internet did in the 90s. And you can see how we regulated that. And I'll candidly say we probably could have done better, right? And if this is advancing more rapidly than that, then we need to make sure not to repeat the same mistakes. And so if we're setting up these committees that are not agile, so that's kind of one of the issues of working by committee is you're a bit more slow with what you're going to do. How are we going to be able to keep up with the pace of the technology itself?
Given you mentioned what Oregon state government is doing, standing up an AI task force, and you had alluded a little bit earlier to some of the attention that AI in elections is getting in Oregon. Given that, given everything else we've talked about today, if you could wave a magic wand and think about the types of regulation that you think are really necessary and would really add value, what would be on that wish list?
I would say that what I would like to see from a regulatory perspective is transparency and accountability. I'm an auditor. So those are the first two words out of my mouth when anybody asks me, what do you want? Well, I want those two things, if nothing else. And what I mean by that is if governments or anyone is going to be using the technology, then it should be clear to the end user that that technology was used. So if I read a report, I need to know if it was generated by a person or generated by Gen AI. If I see a picture or a chart or an image or a table, the same thing applies. If I see data, I need to know that data came where it came from. Can I verify it? Is it reliable? We need these things in place. Similarly, I would need to make sure as an auditor that there's an audit trail attached. How can someone like me be able to go in and trace that information back to its source to make sure that it is complete and reliable and accurate. So that would be probably the first thing that I would like to see. I'd also like to see safety and bias, safety from a public safety perspective. If we're going to rely on it from a transportation perspective, or if we're going to use Gen AI or any future machine learning in autonomous vehicles, like Waymo in California, are people's lives safe around the technology? I feel like that's probably something that we really need to prioritize. We understand that there's bias in Gen AI. How are we addressing that? I think that's an important question to ask and answer. And then just all sorts of ethical use implications. If I, as a public servant, am using it, am I using it for the public's benefit while I am on the public's time? Casey in his personal life can, create pictures for his kids or whatever. But if I'm on the, public dollar and, am I just sitting at work playing on ChatGPT, coming up with funny, stories to share with my coworkers, or am I actually using the Gen AI in the interest of the public? And I think that's something. The next thing is around workforce and development and education. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. And ensuring that we have a workforce that is ready for any implementation that we have, and making sure that the next generation of workers is also ready, and then a public kind of awareness effort on the same front, I think, would be important. But I think overall, no matter what the case, we would need to make sure that these frameworks are adaptable, so that there's continuous monitoring in place and that they adapt. Because as I alluded to earlier, and as you're well aware, the technology is advancing so very rapidly that if we think that we can just institute a regulation, create a committee, write a law, and leave it at that, then we're going to set ourselves up to fail in the long run. And I would like to avoid that personally.
Well, thanks so much, Casey Kopcho, Principal Auditor with the Oregon Secretary of State. Appreciate all your thoughts today on AI, Furbies, Knight Rider, and all kinds of exciting things. Really, really interesting perspective. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. We'll come back whenever called.
Well, thanks again to Casey for really covering a lot of ground there about a way to think about artificial intelligence, both in state government and personal lives. And I think it's a lot of pieces in there we'll be coming back to again and again over this season and the next. The piece I pulled for this week's Ripped from the Headlines does kind of illuminate some of the things that Casey was talking about. It was originally published by the Nebraska Examiner, which is part of the state's newsroom, which is a nonprofit state reporting association. It's written by Zach Wendling, and it's called Civic Nebraska Hosts AI and Democracy Summit at UNL Ahead of Legislative Hearing. And so it's about exactly what the headline advertises. So there was this summit and on AI and democracy, which I think that alone to me is very interesting. And it's just a kind of a slew of what people in Nebraska, university professors, people in the private sector are thinking about and in terms of AI. So I'm going to kind of run through some of the biggies here. So they have a director of public policy for Civic Nebraska who's talked about how there were robocalls in January using President Joe Biden's voice to trick voters ahead of the New Hampshire primary. In 5,000 AI-generated calls, people were discouraged from voting. So there's the election concern. A Nebraska State Senator, Tom Brewer, suggested that the government and judiciary committees should investigate AI, possibly providing momentum to propel 2025 legislation up the food chain. There's again that kind of studying bit that we've referenced a few times. Just in terms of, we've talked about cost, but the article mentions U.S. election hardware and systems are methodical and more protected than anywhere else in the world. However, the election officials and workers are not protected. The article quotes the University of Nebraska's Gina Ligon, who says that if you get enough of these threats, enough of these videos made about you, you're maybe not going to volunteer to be an election official anymore. And that's something that I think I haven't heard too much about. It talks about deep fakes or deceptive images and videos of election officers. There's a bill right now in Nebraska that would crack down on threats and harassments of election officials or election workers and requires an annual report. Another thing that the article touches on is a need for trust, and that social media and AI use can get, or rather AI use can get complicated when it comes to social media. And they also had a professor who teaches a journalism course and said it would be impossible to escape the damage that AI could cause, and that the field is changing so fast his course was like flying a plane with duct tape and a prayer. And he says that we're in an arms race that you can't possibly win. And that we've tried to legislate technology before, but had often run aground on First Amendment or other concerns. Again, something that is certainly being talked about now, but also highlights how difficult it is to keep up with this particular technology. This professor also, on the plus side, said AI could expand community news, which has been shrinking nationwide. I actually recently had a long story short that touched on local news, and it could be used to systematically review voter polls. Another way that it could be used to its advantage is a Douglas County official talked about voter drop boxes and how you could have associated cameras to the quasi-public safety tools that could review these drop boxes and the associated cameras to identify a suspect should there be an issue. And this official from Douglas County says, I don't have the staff, the time, or the funds to sit there and monitor those cameras 24/7. So that's just kind of a slew. It sounds like they covered a lot of ground in this forum. But again, it just kind of demonstrates the range of things that the AI can touch, and also kind of, to me, makes that connection between what's the role of state and local government here for the greater good. What were some of the things that you took away from the article, Justin?
Yeah, it's a great piece. I'm glad to have a chance to talk about it, because like you said, it really does bring this down literally to the ground level. And we're talking about elections officials in Nebraska. I mean, it doesn't get any more on the ground than that. As you were describing this, and as I had looked at it before, it's just dollar signs across the board at the local level. As the election official mentioned, you know, I don't have the dollars, I don't have the resources to be able to have the human capital needed to do the human side of mm-hmm. cybersecurity and election security. That's a really, really good point. As a commercial for a future Public Money Pod episode, we're going to be talking about exactly that question, how we pay for local elections, in large part because of exactly these kinds of questions. But then you could imagine an analogous thing playing out in all kinds of other local government services. The systems that run water sewer systems, you know, the computers that run water sewer systems are vulnerable. And so how do you harden those systems, and how do you have the human capital that you need to protect those systems? And are the people who work at public utilities vulnerable to that kind of very personalized attack that we've seen play out against elections officials and others? The answer is probably yes. So that's more money needed to be spent, more resources having to be devoted to something that has never really been a part of the budget for water sewer systems, you know, local water sewer systems. Takes us into the public safety space. There's not very little getting in the way of these kinds of deep fake, whatever you want to call them, mimicking all kinds of attacks on public safety, on police officers, on firefighters, on you name it. So it just really brings home that cybersecurity and all of the attendant sort of risks and disadvantages surrounding these technologies will inevitably mean more money spent. And it's just not clear where those dollars are going to come from. There's been some interesting research as of late, too, looking specifically at the relationship between cyber attacks and borrowing costs at the local level. And not surprisingly, we're finding that places that have had a lot of cyber attacks also then see their borrowing costs increase in the aftermath of that attack, which makes perfect sense. If you're an investor and you're concerned about whether there's a threat to the operations of that entity, its ability to generate revenue and deliver services, that's a threat to its ability to repay its debt. So you as an investor may not get repaid. And then you create this kind of double whammy then, where you're paying more to borrow and you don't have the resources to put into the cybersecurity in the first place. Where does that stop? So it really raises all kinds of important questions. And naturally, from a public money perspective, the first thing I think about here is there's really going to need to be regional, state, even federal, maybe even transnational kinds of initiatives and funding sources here, because this is something that's affecting everybody. And I think it's just really difficult to conceive of a way that local folks could pay for these kinds of initiatives with local dollars, much the same way that journalism professor said that this is an arms race we're never going to win. I think the same holds when you take it down to the local level and concerns about spending to protect critical infrastructure systems. That may be something that local governments can't do on their own. Really good. Now, on the flip side of that, really good opportunity for cooperation, really good opportunity to collaborate in a way that we haven't at the intergovernmental level in a long time. If anything is going to force that kind of collaboration, I would think it would be the sort of threats that we're seeing emerge around AI and cybersecurity. Thanks again to our season 2 sponsors, Build America Mutual, MuniPro, Odyssey Advisors, and the Government Finance Officers Association. The Public Money Pod is a production of the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy, where we are proudly produced by Hannah Burnick. You can learn more about the center and its work at munifinance.uchicago.edu. That's munifinance.uchicago.edu. You can learn more about Liz Farmer's work at her Substack, Long Story Short. That's Long Story Short. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Public Money Pod.